has to go outside. "I suppose I ought to be pleased by your initiative," Daddy said. "But what I think about is the permanent damage to your sense of balance that might well have resulted if you two hadn't come back inside in time. You might never have been able to move again without suffering vertigo." The thought alone was enough to make me queasy. Daddy finished by settling a punishment of not being able to go anywhere for a month. For a month, after class with Mr. Mbili or survival class, I had to come straight home and stay there. Miss Brancusick then and there meted out the same restriction to Jimmy. In some ways, that was the hardest month I ever spent, cooped up in the apartment and not able to go anywhere. Sitting at home when other people were free to come and go, free to play soccer, to go folk dancing at night, or to sit around the common room while Jimmy and I had to go check in. In other ways, it wasn't entirely a loss. For one thing, it gave me time to think about my character deficiencies. I didn't think of them in those terms, but I did determine not to be any more stupid than was absolutely necessary, which is much the same thing. Also, since we were both stuck in our own homes, Jimmy and I did quite a lot of talking, and I got to know him better. The first thing we did when our month was over was go to Salvage, detouring around Mrs. Keithley, and apologize to Mr. Mitchell. It was one of the hardest things I've ever had to do. I never wore my pin until I was back on good terms with him. Then it was all right. Chapter 11. We received our automatic promotions from sixth class to fifth in the fall when first class went off on trial, and another group of younger kids began training. Through the fall, as we approached the end of our first 6 months of training, we one by one turned 13. Not only was I the smallest one in the class, not that I minded, since being cute little black-haired Mia Habero never hurt anything, but my birthday was last. It came, as always, on Saturday, November 29th. One of the advantages of a permanent calendar is that it gives you something to count on. On my birthday, Mother made a special trip to see us. Well, she spent the day with Daddy. She presented me with one of her sculptures, and I thanked her politely. She didn't like being thanked for some reason, and I assure you that I was nice, and left the room. Daddy, who isn't always as single-minded or as busy as you might think, had done something that I would never have thought of. He called the library, and they made a search of all their recordings and sent him a fair copy of no less than 5 Penny Whistle records. I once, believe it or not, went through a stage of thinking the Andrew Johnson books were all mine and nobody else knew about them, and it was something of a shock to learn that they did. The Penny Whistle records that Daddy gave me didn't produce quite the same feeling of losing something private, but I would never have dreamed that anyone would ever have recorded Penny Whistle music. I thanked Daddy and kissed his cheek. I had never been able to be demonstrative when I was younger, but since we had moved to GeoQuad, somehow it came easier, like a lot of things. The biggest surprise of my birthday was Jimmy D. He asked me to go to the theater with him. I think he was frightened when he did, and that surprised me. I'd always thought that he saw me as, at best, a brother in arms, and not as a girl at all. The play was put on in the amphitheater where they hold Ship's Assembly, and we actually went to it instead of watching it on the vid. It was Richard B. Sheridan's School for Scandal, and except that I got a little sweaty in the palms of my hands, something that had never happened at home and that I can only attribute to my being excited, I enjoyed myself thoroughly. I was excited all evening, too. When we got home, Jimmy took my hand and touched the palm with his finger. "Your hand is sweaty," he said. I looked up at him, and I nodded. He said, "So is mine." And he showed me, and it was. Jimmy kissed me then. In spite of what they say, I was a little surprised. I had no idea that he wanted to, though I'd been hoping he would. It shows you what secret passions you can arouse. It was the first time anybody had ever kissed me like that, and it made my heart pound and my hands sweat even more. Whatever I've forgotten, I've remembered that birthday. It was almost as though Jimmy and I had invested something of ourselves, because after that, we had an unspoken understanding. Instead of carping at each other all the time, we only fought when we were mad. You can't squabble in public with somebody you sometimes kiss privately. Or at least I found I couldn't. Of course I didn't tell anybody. I wouldn't want them to think I was changing. Since I was now 13, trial was less than a year away. But somehow, I wasn't quite as awed by the thought as I once had been. It no longer seemed as deadly a thing as it once had, though I did know that far from everyone returned. Survival class gave me an amazing amount of confidence. For one thing, it made what we had to face more of a known quantity, and the unknown, unnameable, might-be-anything is always more frightening than the known. Trial was beginning to look more and more like 30 days among the mud-eaters. Soonest begun, soonest done. And not much more, though there were some moments when I was surer of this than others. The moments when I wasn't quite so sure that trial would be a waltz usually came after one of the afternoons we spent watching various white-fanged this-and-thats come charging efficiently across the projection screen to slice down some galumphing creature 3 times their size. Wham! But survival class also taught us to deal with completely strange things. Many didn't seem to have very much to do with trial, either. Dancing, needlepoint, parachuting. The thing is that once you've discovered that you can do a lot of strange and demanding things, and sometimes even do them well, then coping with the unknown doesn't seem quite as hard. When they ask you to raise a log cabin, you don't object that you never expect the opportunity to come up during trial. You do it. You learn that you can do it. And you even learn one or two things that might come in handy. In December, 42 kids who were exactly a year older than we were scattered across the western hemisphere of New Dalmatia. They were dropped one at a time with horses and packs, and no clear idea of where they were or what planet they were on, then got waved goodbye to. Also in December, about 1 week later, 31 of us kids went on a 3-day field trip with Mr. Marischal and an assistant named Pizarro, also to New Dalmatia. The differences, of course, were that we knew where we were going, what we would find there, how long we were going to stay, and a few other non-essentials like that. 4 horses were taken, large draft animals. All of us kids came down to the scout bay with good shoes on our feet, heavy clothing, and backpacks. We'd been issued these when we started survival class. I'd outgrown my shoes, however, and been issued new pairs, and I was almost ready to ask for a larger set of clothes. As we went on board, I saw Mr. Pizarro and Mr. Marischal counting us off. They weren't too obvious about it, because there was that set idea of the voluntary nature of survival class, and they make a point of not checking up. Still, they wanted to know how many they were taking. Somebody would be bound to say something if they came back a half dozen short. Mr. Pizarro was our pilot. When everybody was aboard, everybody meaning all 31 of us, nobody missing, I happened to know that Robert Briney got out of bed with a cracked rib, his horse kicked him, to come along. They raised the ramp and took off. There was some nervous talking and joke-telling. Mr. Marischal was even tolerant enough not to tell everybody to be quiet. I picked a chair against the partition that separated the walk-around from the bullpen where we were sitting. I've never been at my best in groups like that. Where there are only a few people that I know well, I talk. But where there are crowds, I fade into the background. Besides, I had something to do. At and Jimmy did come over, though. "What are you writing?" At asked. I put down my notebook. "Ethics notes," I said. "I'm organizing my ideas for a paper Jimmy and I have to do for Mr. Mbili." Jimmy asked, "How are you doing it?" I took his hand and ran a finger across the back of it. "I'm not asking you that. You'll see when I'm done." Big At sat down and then said, "What sort of a thing does it have to be?" Jimmy mussed my hair lightly and said, "No one particular thing. It has to be on the subject of ethics." I ducked my head away from Jimmy's hand and said, "You seem nervous, At." "A little, I guess," he said. "I've never been down on a planet. I don't see how you can be so calm and just sit here and write."
"Scribble," Jimmy said.
"It's not so new for me," I said. "I've been down before. Her dad takes her when he goes.
Jimmy said. After a few more minutes, Jimmy and At broke out a pocket chess set and began to play, and I turned to my notes. I finished off utilitarianism before we landed. Ethics is the branch of philosophy that concerns itself with conduct, questions of good and evil, right and wrong. Almost every ethical system, and there are a great many of them because even people who supposedly belong to the same school don't agree a good share of the time and have to be considered separately, can be looked at as a description and as a prescription. Is this what people actually do? Is this what people ought to do? Skipping the history and development of utilitarianism, the most popular expression of the doctrine is the greatest good for the greatest number, which makes it sound like it's relative. The economic philosophy, communism, which, in a sense, is what we live with in the ship. The common expression of utilitarian good is the presence of pleasure and the absence of pain. Speaking descriptively, utilitarianism doesn't hold true, though the utilitarian claims that it does. People do act self-destructively at times. They know the pleasureful and choose the painful instead. The only way that what people do and what utilitarianism says they do can be matched is by distorting the ordinary meanings of the words pleasure and pain. Besides, notions of what is pleasurable are subject to training and manipulation. The standard is too shifting to be a good one. I don't like utilitarianism as a prescription either. Treating pleasure and pain as quantities by which good can be measured seems very mechanical, and people become just another factor to adjust in the equation. Pragmatically, it seems to make sense to say, 100 lives saved at the cost of one? Go ahead. The utilitarian would say it every time. He would have to say it. But who gave him the right to say it? What if the one doesn't have any choice in the matter, but is blindly sacrificed for, say, 100 mud-eaters whose very existence he is unaware of? Say the choice was between Daddy or Jimmy and 100 mud-eaters. I wouldn't make a utilitarian choice, and I don't think I could be easily convinced that the answer should be made by use of the number of pounds of human flesh involved. People are not objects. We sat down in a great nest of trees in bright morning sunshine. The air was clear and brisk. The season was early summer, and things were in bloom. The gravity was enough less than normal that it was noticeable, but not enough less to cause discomfort. We landed in a valley by a quiet river. Our side of the river was gentle, with great trees rising from a springy floor. But the other side of the river was a 60-foot bluff, rough-edged, marked by protrusions of rock, ledges, and occasional bits of greenery. I grabbed up my pack by the straps, slung it over my shoulder, and went trooping outside with everybody else, down the ramp, and into the sun and the cool air. In my pack were a change of clothes, a change of shoes, manual toothbrush, hairbrush, bedroll, and some odds and ends. We had bubble tents, but we had been told not to bring them. I had a heavy shirt and a light shirt underneath, and since the pocket in the outer shirt was small and the shirt was beginning to be tight through the shoulders and across the breast, I dropped my notebook down my shirt front. It would stay as long as I stayed buttoned and tucked. I squinted as I came into the sun. The trees stretched serenely upwards as though nothing could ever ruffle their composure. The river moved silently past and then curved away, and the light made patches of light and dark as it cut through the trees, alleys in which dust motes could be seen swimming. The chatter of a bird was the only counterpoint to the noise we made. Most of the kids had never been on a planet before, and this was a gentle, pleasant introduction. The wind blew lightly, toying with my hair and sleeve, and died again. The horses were led out after us, along with harnesses, ropes, and chains. Mr. Marischal called for us to gather around. "The first 15 of you will be with Mr. Pizarro," he said. "That's through Mather. From Morlock on, you'll be with me. We're going to build cabins today, and tomorrow, too, if it takes that long. Mr. Pizarro thinks that his group can build a cabin faster than my group can. We're going to see about that." That was an obvious sort of appeal, but it sounded like fun. so I didn't even giggle. Jimmy, Riggy, Robert Briney, that farmer boy, and the Herskovitz boy were all in my group. Venny and Helen and At were in Mr. Marischal's group. Jimmy yanked at my sleeve, and we followed Mr. Pizarro away from Mr. Marischal to a place of our own. He sat down on a rock and motioned us to take places on the springy ground around him. Mr. Pizarro was a young man with a narrow face and a brushy red mustache.
"All right," he said. "What we are going to build is a log cabin, 15 by 20 feet. We're going to need about 60 logs. I want all of you kids to get some experience in felling trees, but the boys will do most of it. This is what the cabin will look like."
He sketched in the dirt with a stick.
"This is going to be as good a cabin as we can make in this short time. We're going to have floors and doors and windows. But this isn't going to be as good a cabin as it might be. Any guesses why?"
Somebody raised his hand, and Mr. Pizarro called on him.
"Well, if we cut them down, the logs are going to be green. They won't dry evenly, and the walls will let air in."
"Right," Mr. Pizarro said. "We'll chink the walls as best we can now."
After we had discussed the cabin for a few more minutes, Mr. Pizarro led the way down the hill to a level place near the river. Here the cabin outlines had already been marked, and two saw pits had been dug in the ground. Mr. Marischal's group was already down here. Mr. Pizarro said,
"Mr. Marischal and I came down here last Saturday to mark our spots, blaze our trees, and make the saw pits. This is just to make the work faster. When you cut a tree, try to decide why we picked it, rather than some of the others around."
Then he assigned us to jobs. Tree felling, horse handling and log hauling, log peeling, and so on. Jack Fernandez Fragoso and I were put on sill laying and lunch. Mr. Pizarro gave us a quick sketch of what we were to do, and then took the rest of the people off to get them started on their jobs. Mr. Marischal left two people like us behind on the other cabin, and we took a look at them already at work, and started on our own job. The side base logs, the long base of the cabin, are the most important, because the cabin rests on them. They have to be solidly fitted. The best way to do this is to half-sink them into the ground. Jack and I got shovels and started digging shallow trenches down the long sides of the cabin outlines. We had pegs and string to keep our trenches straight, level, and the same depth. The physical part wasn't too bad, since we had been using hand tools for several months in practice, and our hands were not as blister-prone as they once had been. It was somewhat painstaking, involving a good bit of measuring to keep things even. When we were done, we leveled the interior floor of the cabin. As we worked, we could hear axes ringing in the woods, voices, and sometimes the fall of a tree. Before we had finished the floor, Mr. Pizarro, the two horses, and the two base logs were all present. The logs were dragged in along the riverbank. We came out almost in a tie with the peeling of the logs. Then Jack and I watched as the top quarters of the ends of the logs were cut off. Across these ends would be laid the similarly cut tenons of the base logs of the cabin's short walls, these logs lying on the ground. After that, logs would be laid in alternate rows, long sides of the cabin, then short sides, the tenons allowing the logs to rest on those just below them. Jack and I went off to gather wood then and start lunch. By the time lunch was ready, all four base logs were in place, the long ones sitting half in the ground, the short ones standing higher, and a number of other logs had been brought up by the saw pit. Mr. Marischal's people had done about the same amount here, but I had no idea how much had been done out in the woods. Jack and I ate before everybody else, and then served. I went over and sat with Jimmy and Riggy while they ate. Jimmy had been felling trees, Riggy cutting poles, and they and I were both pleased to have the free hour after lunch that Mr. Pizarro allowed us. There is nothing like doing physical labor to give you reason to think, if only to pass the time. So I had more thoughts for my ethics paper on the subject of stoicism. I got out my notebook and wrote them down. Jimmy and Riggy just rested. The trouble with stoicism, it seems to me, is that it is a soporific.
It affirms the status quo, and thereby puts an end to all ambition, all change. It says, as Christianity did 1,000 years ago, that kings should be kings, and slaves should be slaves. And it seems to me that that is a philosophy infinitely more attractive to the king than to the slave. It is much the same as the question of determination and free will. Whether or not your actions are determined, you have to act on the assumption that you have free will. If you are determined, your attempt at free will loses you nothing. However, if you are not determined and you act on the assumption that you are, you will never attempt anything. You will simply be a passive blob that things happen to. I am not a passive blob. I have changed, and I think at least some of it is my own doing. As long as I have any hope, I could not possibly be a stoic. In the afternoon, I walked with Jimmy behind Mr. Pizarro to chop down my tree. We followed the skid marks of previous logs along the edge of the riverbank. The sun was bright, and the air a little warmer now. I couldn't help thinking that this was very pleasant, although it was nothing like home. After a few hundred yards, we cut away from the river and up a ridgeline. The underbrush was very thin, and there was a rust-brown carpet of shed tree leaves over the ground. The boys who had been chopping trees before went back to work. There were several trees down and cut into logs waiting to be dragged away. Mr. Pizarro pointed at a gray tree trunk with a white mark on it. "That's your tree," he said, as the cling of axes and the whir-whir of saws started around us. I walked around the tree and looked up at it. Finally, just as we had been told and shown, I picked the direction I wanted it to fall. I didn't want it to fall on anybody, and I wanted it to fall where it could be cut and hauled away. Then I braced my feet, lifted my axe, and started my undercut. This is a small cut in the tree on the side you wish it to fall. The axe struck the tree and made a gash. Once again, and a big chip flew. When I had my undercut, I stopped to rest. "Very good," Mr. Pizarro said. "When you are done, send Sonia up here. You know what you are doing this afternoon, don't you?" "Yes," I said. He nodded and walked away then. He was overseeing all the different jobs that we were doing, plus doing a good bit of the heaviest work himself. You could expect him to be at your elbow 1 minute and then gone the next. He had come and tasted a spoonful of the soup while I was making it that morning. As he walked away, somebody yelled, "Stand clear!" And we all looked up. One of the trees was ready to fall. There was a ravine between us, and both of our trees were aimed to fall there, this one about 30 feet closer to the river than mine. Mr. Pizarro moved up the hill away from it. The boy, seeing everyone clear, pushed the tree and stepped back. It wasn't cut completely through, but the undercut projected beneath the major cut, and the push was enough to break through the bit of wood between. The tree wavered, and then, with majestic slowness, toppled forward. In the silence left by the quieted axes, there was the sound of wood breaking, of branches crashing, and then a great splintering rack as it smashed against the ground, raising dirt. Then the axes started again. I moved around to the uphill side of my tree and started my major cut. I stopped from time to time to catch my breath and kick damp aromatic chips. At last it was beginning to waver, and I knew it was ready to fall. I yelled, "Everybody stand clear!" and checked to see that everybody was. Then I pushed the tree and stepped back. My foot skidded on a chip, and I sat down hard, looking up at the tree. At first I thought I was wrong, and it wasn't going to fall at all. But then it slowly tottered away from me. It fell, and when it hit the ground, the butt snapped clean from the stump, leapt high, and then smacked back against the ground only a few feet away. The treetop that had been high over my head was now 50 feet below me in the gully. The tree, landing on the slope, slid forward a few feet and then came to a stop. I looked down at it with a great deal of satisfaction. Then I got to my feet, dusted off the seat of my pants, picked up my axe, and started back to where the cabin was going up. I waved at Jimmy as I passed. Of the 15 of us, 7 were girls. 5 had cut down their trees in the morning, the only ones who hadn't being me and Sonia. So I found her making a door for the cabin with Riggy. The saw pit was now turning out slabs from medium-sized logs, the slabs being really half-logs, flat on one side, round on the other. The slabs were to be used for shutters, doors, roof, and cabin floor. In the case of the door, the poles cut in the morning were being nailed to the flat sides of slabs about 6 feet long. I gave Sonia my axe and sent her along to find Mr. Pizarro, looked at the saw pit in operation for a minute, and then turned to my afternoon job. In the pit, one person gets down in it, one person stands on the ground above, and the log is sawed between them. The only disadvantage is that the person on the bottom gets sawdust in his hair, but if you switch off, this evens out. My afternoon job was taking the mud and moss brought by the mud and moss detail, Juanita, and chinking the cracks between the logs. By the time I got back, the two boys on the walls were working on their third tier of logs. They had skids in place and were now looping ropes around the logs and pulling them up the skids and into place. I happily went along pushing my mud and moss into place, thinking of ethics and whiling the afternoon away as the walls rose. After Riggy finished the door and shutters, Mr. Pizarro showed up and they stopped putting up walls for a while. By that time, the walls were high enough that I felt surrounded, tall enough that I had to stand on a cut block to do my chinking. Where I had yet to chink, the light slanted through to cut across the shadowed floor. Mr. Pizarro climbed over the logs then, needing a little boost, and borrowed my block to stand on. Then he and Riggy cut through the solid logs to make the windows. They made 2 cuts for each window and removed the sections of log. It was then easier to get in and out, which was good because the logs were becoming harder to raise into place. Riggy came inside, and instead of 2 boys raising logs, there were now 3 boys and Mr. Pizarro, plus me when Juanita didn't have enough mud and moss for me and they needed a hand. When there were 2 more rows of logs in place, they cut the door in the same way as the window, and suddenly the cabin wasn't a tight little box anymore. Everybody was coming in from the woods then, and I went out of the cabin through the hole that was a doorway. Juanita and I made 1 last trip for mud together while they were raising the last log into place over the door. When we came back with the mud, everybody pitched in and we finished the outside chinking. It was great fun, and at the end we just took mud and threw it at each other. I caught Jimmy a great gob across the back, and he returned the favor. All 15 of us were running around throwing mud, while Mr. Pizarro stayed out of range and watched us. When we were all out of mud, he said, "What are you going to do? You only have 1 spare change of clothes." Jimmy looked at the river, gave an onward ho point of the finger, and said, "There we are." He sat down, pulled off his shoes, and then made a dash, fully clothed, for the river, plopped through the shallows and made a plunge into the water. I had my shoes kicked off in an instant, and my notebook out of my shirt, and followed right after. The water was clear and cold, not too swift, and just fine for swimming. It was much better than my 1 previous planetary swimming experience. We all splashed and made grampus noises in the late afternoon sun, flipped water at each other, and had a real old-fashioned time. Very quickly we were joined by Mr. Marichal's group, who were not mud-covered, but most of whom had gotten reasonably dirty or sawdust covered in the course of the day, and knew a good thing when they saw it. We stayed in until we were called out, and then we came out soggy. Our leaders were willing to make 1 concession to the good usages of civilization, and we took our clothes to the scout ship to be quickly dried. The rest of our weekend, sleeping arrangements, hand-done work, hand-prepared food, was simple enough to please Thoreau, who I am convinced was a nice fellow who confused rustic vacations with life. We did get this 1 concession, though. After dinner, freshly dressed, full of food and a warm glow, and thoroughly tired, I wandered over to look at the other cabin along with Jimmy. It was about as far toward completion as ours. That is, the walls were in place and chinked, and the door and window holes were cut. But it looked odd. One of the long walls was higher than the other, and higher than any of our walls. It gave the cabin an odd, unfinished look, a hunchbacked look. We had been issued bubble tents, which can be folded to pocket size and are proof against almost anything, but we had been told not to bring them. Instead, we unrolled our beds near the fire and took our chances in the open. I was one of those who drew guard duty, but I was lucky enough to get second hour. I stayed awake, relieved Stu Herskovitz, who hadn't seen anything, and walked for an hour around the camp. I didn't see anything except people ready to go to sleep. I yawned my way through the hour, then got Vishwa Mathur up and went to sleep myself. There were clouds over the sky in the morning, and it was gray through breakfast and cold. But then the clouds began to break into white pieces and move apart, and then the sky was clear again and it was bright. We raised the gable ends of the roof into place and fit the doors and shutters. Then, all of us working, we raised the three roof logs into place, the ridge pole on top, the other two below on either side, forming a slope. As we were finishing, somebody looked over at the Marischal cabin and saw what they were doing. They were slanting a roof from the tall wall across the short one. "That's not fair," I yelled. "You're building a shed, not a cabin." "Ho, ho, too bad," Venny called back. We booed. We laid the poles that Riggy and Sonia had collected the day before over fitted slabs to make the roof. I was inside the cabin helping to lay the floor. The slabs of wood were laid rounded side down, side by side, to make a reasonably flat floor, which is called a puncheon floor. If we had had the time, we would have smoothed the flat sides, but as it was, we couldn't. The result was a floor that I wouldn't recommend walking on in bare feet, unless you have a genuine affection for splinters. But it was a good, solid floor. Jimmy was on the roof laying slabs, stuffing moss, and placing poles. A little of the moss filtered through as they worked, but the roof closed in quickly over our heads, and when they were done, it looked as solid as our floor. We were clearly beaten by Mr. Marischal's group, which finished almost an hour before we did, and then came over and made comments, but we were done before noon, too. I looked over the other building when we were done, along with some curious friends, and I'll have to honestly say that I preferred our cabin to their shed. Better workmanship. In the afternoon, we relaxed with an easy hike and then a swim, this one in suits, not in our clothes. After that, I got out my notebook again and made some more ethics notes. These about an easy one, the philosophy of power. In effect, the philosophy of power says that you should do anything you can get away with. If you don't get away with it, you were wrong. You really can't argue with this, you know. It is a self-contained system, logically self-consistent. It makes no appeal to outside authority, and it doesn't stumble over its own definitions. But I don't like it. For one thing, it isn't a very discriminating standard. There doesn't seem to be any possible difference between ethically good and ethically better. More important, however, Stoics strap themselves in ethically so that their actions have as few results as possible. The adherents of the philosophy of power simply say that the results of actions have no importance. The philosophy of a 2-year-old throwing a tantrum. We slept that night in the cabin with the door latched, and there was a certain comfort and solidity in sleeping in what we had built. I can also say that the puncheon floor was much harder than the ground had been. Or perhaps I wasn't as tired. The next day was our last of the excursion, and we celebrated it by jumping off the bluff across the river. Then we cleaned up the camp and came home. It was foggy in the morning, and though the fog lifted, the clouds stayed low and gray over our heads. We set out in one big group this morning, with Mr. Marischal leading and Mr. Pizarro bringing up the rear and carrying ropes. Looking at the river, our cabin was on the left and the shed on the right. We had gone upriver for our logs, and Mr. Marischal's group the other way. We went downriver along the riverbank, past the point where their skid tracks went uphill away from the river, and then around the long, slow bend where the river curved out of sight of the camp. It was a gloomy day, but we were in good spirits, chattering as we walked. Our group of six, reunited, walked together. We picked our way along for more than a mile, sometimes having to leave the river edge and move inland, but making a pretty good pace of it. At last we came out on a sand shoal and looked across at an easy bank on the other side of the river and a broken and easily climbed bluff.
"We're going to have to swim," Mr. Marischal said.
He waded out into the water until he was standing in water to his waist, about one quarter of the way across. Then we started across with both of our leaders standing guard. The water was cold, and it wasn't half as much fun to get soaked as it had been the first time. Our clothes are dirt and water resistant and dry quickly, but believe me, it is far nicer to have them dry off you than to have them dry while you are wearing them. On the far bank, I dripped and shivered. We all gathered on the grassy bank, and then Mr. Pizarro and Mr. Marischal splashed and swam across to join us. We climbed through the underbrush and tumbled rock, and by the time we reached the top of the bluff, if I wasn't fully dry, at least I wasn't shivering. The bluff was covered with forest, too, but standing on the edge we could see the easy, forest-covered slope on the other side from above, a dark green rising carpet. Then we turned into the woods and didn't come out again until we were standing on the bluff edge opposite our camp. I didn't like standing on the edge, so I came up to the lip on my knees and looked down at the river. It looked a long way down, a drop big enough to kill you, and after that, distances are academic. At the base, there looked to be just room to stand and no more. As it had been explained to us, the two ropes would be tied in place here at the top of the bluff, and then each of us would whip the ropes around our waists and step off the cliff backward. Looking down, I didn't exactly relish the idea. I moved back from the edge and then got to my feet.
"Well," Mr. Marischal said, "who's going to be the first to try it?"
Jimmy said, "Mia and I will." Mr. Marischal looked at me and I said, "Yes." I didn't like the thought of doing it, but if it was something expected of everybody and I was going to have to do it eventually, I didn't mind doing it first and getting it over with. The ropes were tied to trees and then passed around our waists, around the main ropes, and then back around the waists again. Mr. Pizarro and Mr. Marischal demonstrated for everybody how this worked. The ends were finally dropped back between our legs and over the edge of the cliff to dangle just above the river. In effect, what we were doing was putting ourselves in a running loop that slid freely on the rope and then moving down the rope to the river. At the signal, we stood with our backs to the river, the rope taut between us and our trees. I looked down at the river and sighed, then stepped backward off the edge. I let line pay out for a moment, and then it stopped and swung in to come to a halt with my feet against the cliff face, my body hanging in the loop from the tree on the cliff above. I was almost surprised that it worked. Then I pushed off again and went down another 6 or 7 feet. This was not hard at all, and rather fun. I looked over at Jimmy and laughed. Then, almost before I knew it, I was at the bottom. The bank here was wider than it looked from above, 4 or 5 feet wide, and Jimmy and I landed at almost the same moment. We pulled the ropes free and waved up at the people on top.
"It's easy," Jimmy called. "It's fun," I said.
The ropes were snaked up again to the top of the bluff as we watched. Jimmy said,
"There's no sense in staying down here.
Let's go across the river." We swam across again and then watched while the next pair rappelled down the cliff. We sat on the last completed part of the cabin, a slab doorstep. As we watched, I said,
"Thank you for volunteering me, by the way."
"I know," Jimmy said.
"You're a reluctant daredevil. Aren't you the person who used to crawl around in the air ducts?"
"That was different," I said. "That was my idea." Chapter 12. At the end of December, just in time for year end, the kids on trial on New Dalmatia were brought home. Of the 42 kids who were dropped, 7 didn't signal for pickup and didn't come home.
One of the seven was Jack Brophy, whom I'd known slightly in Alfing Quad. I thought about that, and I couldn't help wondering whether I would come back to the ship in a year. I didn't dwell on the thought, though. Year-end is the sort of holiday that takes your mind off the unpleasant, and besides, I discovered something else that occupied my thoughts and gave me something of a new perspective on my mother. Year-end is a 5 or 6 day bash, 5 days in 2198, which wasn't a leap year. In one of the old novels I read, I discovered that before the calendar was reformed, the extra day of leap year was tacked on to February. This was as part of a mnemonic that was supposed to help you remember how many days there were in each month. My adaptation of it for our calendar would go, 30 days hath January, February, March, April, May, June, July, August, September, October, November, and December. I have a pack rat memory. I even know what a pack rat was. Under our system, the extra day gets tacked onto year end. I was in charge of fixing up our apartment for year end. Jimmy and I made a trip down to the ship's store on second level and picked out a piñata in the shape of a giant chicken and painted it in red, green, and yellow. Jimmy's dorm had a piñata, of course, but the impersonality of the dorm took a lot of fun out of year end, and I had arranged with Daddy for Jimmy to share ours. Between the two of us, Jimmy and I fixed the apartment very nicely and planned the parties we were having on day two for our group of six and some of our other friends, and the big party on New Year's Eve, more or less an open house for anybody who cared to walk in. Since that ticked off an obligation for Daddy, who has no patience for things like party arranging, he was just as glad to have us do it. In Alfing Quad, I had had many friends, but I had almost never brought them home. These days, having people around the place, particularly Jimmy, who lived in GeoQuad, was a regular thing. Daddy has his own patterns of living. In some ways, he lives in a private world, and you would have thought that he would object to having strange kids permanently underfoot. I'm sure his life was disturbed, but he never objected. In fact, he even went out of his way to make it clear that he approved of Jimmy. "He's a good boy," Daddy said. "I'm glad you're seeing a lot of him." Of course, this wasn't too surprising, since I had a distinct impression that Jimmy was one of the reasons that we were living in GeoQuad. It certainly wasn't an accident that we had been assigned to Mr. Mbili as a tutor at the same time. I even had an impression, partly confirmed, that a talk with the ship's eugenist would have shown that Jimmy's and my meeting was even less of an accident. But this didn't bother me particularly, because there were moments when I distinctly liked Jimmy, and moments when just looking at him made me feel all funny inside. The partial confirmation, as well as another discovery, came when I was prowling through the ship's records. Every common room has a library, and there is a certain satisfaction in using them, because there is something unique about the size and shape and feel of a real physical book. And there is real discovery about running your eye along a line of books and picking one out because it somehow looks right. But simple space limitations make a physical collection of all the books that the ship holds out of the question. So standard practice is to look over titles and contents by vid, and then to order a facsimile, a physical copy, if you really want or need one. There are, of course, certain things that most people don't ordinarily look at without some special reason, like ship's records. And while I had no special reason beyond curiosity, I was quite willing to look and quite willing to presume upon Daddy's position in the ship to make it look possible for me to look.
"Are you sure?" the librarian said. "They're not very interesting, you know, and I'm not sure that you really ought to be allowed."
I swear that I didn't exactly say that Daddy, Miles Havero, ship's chairman, had told me that I could, and was willing to discuss the point at length with the librarian if he insisted. But I think if you talked to him, the librarian might have had an impression that I had said it. In any case, I got to look at the records. As I've said, I found some 20-year-old eugenics recommendations that gave me pause, but it wasn't until I looked at me, or more properly, Mother and Daddy, that I discovered something that really rocked me. I had a brother. That was a shock. I switched off the vid, and it faded away. And then I turned to my bed
and just lay huddled there for a long while, thinking. I didn't know why I hadn't been told. I remembered that somebody had once asked me, or talked to me, or tickled me into wondering about brothers and sisters, but I couldn't place the memory, and I had never done anything about it. Finally, I went back to the vid, and I found out about my brother. His name had been Joe, Jose. He had been nearly 40 years older than I, and dead for more than 15 years. I dug around and found out more. Apparently, he had been as conscious as I of the lack of creative writing in the ship. He had written a novel, something I would never do, particularly after I read his. It was not just bad, it was terrible, and it gave me some reason to think that perhaps the ship just isn't a viable topic for fiction. In other respects, Joe was much more competent. He'd been regarded as quite a comer in his branch of physics. His death had been the result of a grotesque and totally unnecessary accident, not of his own making. He had not been discovered immediately, and when he was, it was too late to revive him. His death had apparently bothered my mother greatly. Now that I knew, I didn't know what to do about it. Finally, in a quiet moment, I approached Daddy, and as impersonally as I could, I asked him about it. He looked puzzled.
You know all about Joe, he said. You haven't asked about him in a long time, but I've told you 20 times.
I said, I didn't even know he existed until a week ago.
Mia, he said seriously, when you were 3, you used to beg for stories about Joe.
Well, I don't remember now, I said. Will you tell me? So Daddy told me about my brother. He even said that we were a lot alike in looks and personality. I didn't talk to Mother because I didn't know what I could say about it. I cannot really talk to her. The only person besides Daddy that I talked to was Jimmy, and he made a comment that was perceptive, whether or not it was accurate. He said that maybe I hadn't remembered because I hadn't wanted to, at least until now, and that finding of the record of my brother wasn't as much of an accident as I thought. To tell you the truth, that got me mad at first. And it was my getting mad that later made me think that there might have been some truth to it. The cost was that Jimmy and I didn't speak for 2 days. Thinking in psychological terms got me to thinking about my mother, about her keeping me at arm's length, and about her becoming unhappy when I was nice to her. I finally came to the conclusion that maybe it wasn't me, Mia, the individual, that bothered her, but just me, the physical fact, and I proceeded on that basis. I can't say that I liked her any better, but we did manage to deal together more pleasantly after that. Something else changed that winter, what I thought I wanted from life. It came as a direct result of the papers on ethics that Jimmy and I did. We met in Mr. Mbili's apartment and talked about our conclusions over the usual refreshments provided by Mrs. Mbili. She was a very comfortable person to have around. Very nice. It was our regular Friday night meeting. My paper was a direct discussion and comparison of 6 ethical systems, concentrating on what seemed to me to be their flaws. I finished by saying that it struck me that all the ethical systems I was discussing were after the fact. That is, that people act as they are disposed to, but they like to feel afterward that they were right, and so they invent systems that approve of their dispositions. This was to say that while I found things like, so act as to treat humanity, whether in your person or in that of another, in every case as an end, and not as a means merely, quite attractive principles, I hadn't run onto any system that exactly fitted my disposition. In his discussion, Jimmy took another tack entirely. Instead of criticizing ethical systems, he attempted to formulate one. It was humanistic, not completely unlike some of the others that I had considered. Jimmy started by saying that true humanity was an achievement, not an automatic inheritance. There were things that you could pick at in what he had to say, but his system did have one advantage, and that was that he spoke in terms of a general attitude toward living, rather than in terms of exact principles.
It is too easy to find exceptions to principles.
As I listened, I became increasingly bothered, not by what he was saying, which fit Jimmy's disposition quite closely, but by the sort of paper he was giving. I was the one who was supposed to be intending to be a synthesist, assembling castles from mortar and bricks. Only that wasn't what I had done. It came to me then that I had never done it, making pins or building cabins, putting things together. None of this was really in my line, and I should have seen it long since. I am not a builder, I thought. I am not a tinkerer. It was a moment of pure, unheralded revelation. When Jimmy was done, Mr. Mbili said,
"Let's have a discussion. What comments occur to you? Mia?"
"All right," I said. I turned to Jimmy. "Why do you want to be an ornithologist?" He shrugged.
"Why do you want to be a synthesist?"
I shook my head. "I'm serious. I want an answer."
"I don't see the point. What does this have to do with ethics or what we've just said?"
"Nothing to do with ethics," I said. "It has a lot to do with your paper. You didn't listen to yourself."
"Do you mind explaining yourself a little more fully?" Mr. Mbili said. "I'm not sure I follow you."
"After a while," I said, "I wasn't listening to Jimmy's points. I got thinking about what sort of paper he had put together, and about what sort of paper I'd put together. We had our own choice. It just struck me that if Jimmy really wanted to be an ornithologist, he would have written a paper like mine, a critical paper. And if I were really cut out to be a synthesist, I would have written a paper like Jimmy's, a creative paper. But neither of us did."
"I see," Mr. Mbili said. "As a matter of fact, I think you're right."
Jimmy said, "But I want to be an ornithologist." "That's just because of your grandfather," I said. Mr. Mbili agreed with me almost immediately. But Jimmy had had his aims too long set on ornithology to change his mind easily. It took some time before the sense of it got through to him. But then, he doesn't have a critical mind, and that, of course, was the point. I just made it clear that I now intended to be an ornithologist, and Mr. Mbili accepted that. It was easier for me to change, because when I had thought of the future, I had thought of synthesis, but with parentheses and a question mark after. This change of direction was right for me. And now, when I thought of ornithology, there was no question of any kind in my mind, particularly when Mr. Mbili told me that I had the equipment to make a success at it. And after Jimmy got used to the idea, he finally changed his direction too, because, after all, he was creative. I said, "You're the one who was always thinking up crazy things for us to do. I'm the one who should be thinking why they won't work."
"All right," Jimmy said. "You be the ornithologist, and I'll be the synthesist."
I kissed his cheek. "Good. Then we can still be partners." My change in direction may have been part of growing up. Nearly everything was, or so it seemed these days. I certainly didn't lack for signs of change. One came while Helen Pack and I were down in the ship's store looking for clothes. There is a constant problem of stimulation in living in the ship. If life were too easy, we would all become vegetables. The response has been to make some things more difficult than they might be. This means that shopping is something you do in person and not by vid. Helen and I were in the ship's store not because our clothes had worn out, but because we'd outgrown them. I'd been growing steadily for the last year, but I hadn't caught up with anybody because they had all been growing too. I was now having to wear a bra, which was something new and uncomfortable. And my taste in clothes had developed beyond light shirts, shorts, and sandals. That was partly Helen's doing. She had a good eye for clothes, and she insisted I make more of myself than I had been. "You're pretty enough," she said. "But who's going to know it in the way you dress?" For myself, I didn't care. I would just as soon have lived naturally, and I had no great desire to overwhelm the world. However, there were a few people I wanted to be attractive to, so I put myself in Helen's hands, and by God, I did come out looking better.
Among other things, she got me to wear pink, which went well with my black hair, and which I wouldn't have chosen myself. It all came as a pleasant surprise. Helen said, "It's a matter of emphasizing your best points." She was quite modest about it, but she had reason to be proud. Even Daddy noticed, and Jimmy did, too. No compliments, of course, from Jimmy, though I did get them from Daddy. We were down in the ship store, picking things out, trying them on, piling things up, giggling, rejecting, posing, approving and disapproving. I even found something for Helen that she looked good in. That blonde hair and those oriental eyes. She generally knows what looks good on her. It was pleasant to find something for her that she liked. We were thumbing through racks when I saw somebody I knew, and I said, "Just a second." I waved. It was Zena Andress, who wasn't quite as plump as she once had been. She was looking quite excited, and apparently trying to find someone. She saw me wave, and she came over. "Hi, Mia," she said. "Have you seen my mother?" "No," I said. "Is something the matter?" "Oh, no," she said. "It's nothing bad. I just got my notice. I start survival class next week." "Oh, that's fine," I said. After she'd gone off after her mother again, Helen and I looked at each other. Time does pass. It was only yesterday. Chapter 13. The culmination of survival class came when we were class one and went on a tiger hunt on the third level. It, like so much else, was designed to give us confidence in ourselves. There is nothing like hunting a tiger almost barehanded to give you a feeling of real confidence in yourself, if you manage to survive the experience. Come to think about it, though, we did manage to survive, so maybe there was a point to it. By that time, going down to the third level with Pax was a commonplace. Jimmy and I went down from GeoQuad in the shuttle. I was not in the best of spirits, because I never am before something like that, and I was playing somewhat morosely on the penny whistle. Jimmy said, "You're not going to bring that along, are you?" "Why not?" "I have to admit that you play fairly well now, but if you play like that, you're just going to depress everybody." I said, "I've got campfire entertainment tonight." That was something we had instituted after our second expedition in order to liven camping evenings. "You're not going to play the penny whistle, are you?"
"No," I said. "I was going to tell a story."
"You almost make me change my mind, though."
"Are you afraid?"
He wasn't talking about the campfire entertainment.
"I can't say I relish the thought of throwing rocks at a tiger," I said, "but I guess I'll get used to it. How about you?"
"I'm always scared beforehand," Jimmy said. "That's why I like to talk or play chess."
We got off at Familiar Gate 5 and joined everybody else in getting our helipacks. Mr. Marischal was there with a couple of dogs, and he was being assisted again by Mr.